And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back as we kick off the third and final hour of this Wednesday edition of Feedback. You're on air Town Square here on the voice of Berks and Beyond, News Talk 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders, along with Sean Tansky. And our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800, or toll free if you're calling from out of the area, 888-401-0459. And if you want to text us, you can do so now. Something new we're starting this week. The text number is 484-650-3373. And if you do text us, don't forget to include your first name, the town you live in, and let us know what's on your mind in that text. Right now, I am joined by Bruce Castor, an attorney who has served in a number of public positions in Montgomery County government, as first assistant DA before being elected district attorney for Montgomery County, and then as a county commissioner there. He was appointed as the first solicitor general of Pennsylvania back in March of 2016, and also first deputy attorney general the following July. Castor became acting attorney general less than a month later, when then Attorney General Kathleen Kane was forced to resign, and he has served as Donald Trump's lead attorney in the former president's second impeachment trial. And we welcome Bruce Castor to the show today. Bruce, thank you so much for being with us today. Glad to have you on board.
Well, I'm flattered to be asked. Thank you for having me.
And I've got a lot to talk to you about, and we're going to get to the hearing to hear the arguments on the immunity argument for the president, the former president, in just a bit. But I want to get your take first and foremost on the Supreme Court's ruling last week that states that states themselves cannot block a candidate who's running for federal office from their respective ballots. What are your thoughts on how that turned out?
From a legal perspective, that was a no-brainer. There was no chance that the court would not reverse the Supreme Court in Colorado. In fact, I was asked to become part of that in the Supreme Court, and I guess I quoted too much money because they didn't pick me, and then I got sick, wasn't able to do it. But that case was a guaranteed winner for a whole host of reasons, and I'm not even the slightest bit concerned that the court put together a puzzle in its opinion so that they would get 9-0, but there was no chance that would prevail, and it was a poor strategic choice from the people on the left who are anti-Trump to push that case, because had they not done so, the issue would have been alive the whole rest of the year in state by state, and they would have been able to continue to use that as a campaign issue. By forcing it into the Supreme Court in Colorado and rushing it to its conclusion there, and getting a result that made legally no sense whatsoever, that required the U.S. Supreme Court to take action where it otherwise might not have been required to do it with such alacrity, and took away the campaign issue. As a result, the left not only lost, but they are worse off than they were, because now it looks now they can't use that in Maine or any of the other states where they were trying this, and it looks like they were overreaching in the eyes of the voters, which in my judgment, the fact that they were, and to have the Supreme Court 9-0 with some of those justices being pretty liberal, it was not a good political move for those who were pushing the 14th Amendment argument.
Now, as you pointed out, the court offered up a unanimous decision, but the liberal justices, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, along with Amy Coney Barrett, issued concurrent opinions. Now, what impact, if any, might that have in the future, do you think?
It only has, if you mean impact as far as the country and elections, I don't think it will have any. I think the justices were carving out what they thought was the reason for reversing the Colorado Supreme Court. And remember, when I started to answer this question, I said that there were any number of reasons why I knew that the Colorado Supreme Court would be reversed. And the trick was for Chief Justice Roberts was to find one that all nine of them agreed on.
Right.
And I think the liberal justices and Justice Barrett were simply pointing out that these other reasons that were cited, we don't agree with those, but we do agree with the one that that everybody else agreed with. But from a practical standpoint, it will not affect the election, and it will make it so that this 14th Amendment argument, I guess it's not dead, but it's on life support. I can't see how the amendment could be read any differently than Congress has to put together a series of procedures and protocols that have to be met before it triggers the provision that a federal officer cannot hold future office. And Congress has not done that. And I can't believe that Congress will go down that path anytime soon. So I don't believe that the 14th Amendment argument, in the short term anyway, will be considered by the legal community as anything other than an outright win for the Trump campaign, regardless of the individual reasoning of individual justices.
Well, I think what I'm looking for here is that the three liberal justices and, to a certain extent, Amy Coney Barrett, the lone conservative who issued a concurring opinion in this case, all felt that the court went a little too far in its decision as to where it felt it needed to decide. And forgive me, I'm not a legal expert, so I'm out of my realm in using the proper terminology here. But from that standpoint alone, with what they felt was an overreach, so to speak, for the rest of the court in what they thought they needed to weigh in on in this case, do you think that's going to have an impact going forward, whether it be for Donald Trump or any future president, for that matter?
It will. It's an academic question that you're posing. The concurring opinions were saying that the court only needed to, let's use a 100-point scale, the court only needed to get to 51 in order to reverse the Colorado Supreme Court, and the fact that they went to 75 was more than was needed, and that's not what an appellate court is supposed to do. But the opinion itself, the overall opinion, which is a majority opinion, is still valid law. The fact that you had four concurring opinions tells you that if the unusual situation arises where the federal question falls between the 51% and the 75%, that those four justices might be inclined to review and narrow the decision that was issued in President Trump's favor. So that's sort of how you need to look at it. You have an indication that four of the nine sitting justices thought that the court could have arrived at the same result without having to have been as expansive in their decision. So that the next time a case arises where maybe it's not as obvious as what happened in Colorado, that those four might be willing to modify the decision that came down in favor of the Trump campaign. But the actual use of the 14th Amendment wouldn't be affected. It would just be a sort of a narrowing of it, like the court ruling that you need to have. I'm trying to think of a good example for the listeners that you need to have the in order for the provision of the 14th Amendment restricting somebody from holding federal office to apply, they have to be convicted in a court of law of the following offenses, insurrection, inciting insurrection, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And as opposed to a decision by vote of Congress or something like that, some narrow modification of what constitutes getting over the hurdle of having engaged in insurrection against the United States, because the biggest hole has always in the left's argument has always been that we talk about January 6th so much in the context of it was an insurrection that the common parlance of the day is that it's an established fact that's an insurrection, and that some entity somewhere has ruled that was an insurrection. Well, of course, that has not happened. And in fact, there have been two quasi-judicial or judicial bodies that have looked at it. One of them was the Senate of the United States that I was involved in, said did not constitute the criminal offense of insurrection, because that was charged in the articles of impeachment, and the special prosecutor and the grand jury refused to indict President Trump for that offense on that day. So now the question becomes for the left. The question becomes what has to be done in order to be found to have engaged in insurrection against the United States. So I think most people would think, well, some court has to rule that, and you have to have a right to due process and a right to appeal, and at the other end of it, you're guilty of having engaged in insurrection against the United States. And then the provisions for not being able to hold federal office would become involved. But the left doesn't want that. They want Congress to be able to vote and say that was insurrection. Well, that's the legislative branch of the government deciding whether a person engaged in what is traditionally considered a criminal offense. And in fact, in the impeachment, they charged it as a criminal offense. And if anybody paid attention to the things I said, I defended it on grounds of the elements of insurrection were not made out. There's a federal statute about insurrection and inciting insurrection. Here's what the elements are, and they weren't proven. So that's the next step is to try to get over the hurdle that an insurrection occurred. So bring that back to your question. The justices that did not sign on fully to the majority opinion might be willing to review the question of what's necessary in order for the finding of insurrection to trigger the provisions of the 14th Amendment that affect the ability of a person to run for or to hold federal office. So that's where you get it. I think the traditional view and the majority view would be Congress would have to set up a procedure, and there would have to be a judicial determination that a person had engaged in insurrection, which would then trigger the office holding provision. An alternative view is that a court would not have the authority, the sole authority to do that, and that Congress could do that. One of the things that was a problem for those who were in favor of the ruling by the Supreme Court in Colorado was that you had nobody having made that determination. So the Supreme Court in Colorado determined that they were allowed to decide whether somebody engaged in insurrection. The Secretary of State in Maine decided that she was entitled to make that determination. Well, nobody in America is going to think that's fair. There has to be some opportunity for the person accused to mount a defense. And I think that where it's going to come out is the if we continue down this road, is that Congress will pass and enact legislation that will establish a judicial determination test where due process is granted to the person who is accused, and you have some sort of a judicial proceeding where the person accused gets to mount a defense. What I do not think will happen is that that some patchwork of 50 individual states get to decide what constitutes insurrection and what doesn't, can affect the a national election based on local beliefs. And I don't think that Congress would be foolish enough, although Congress is capable of being foolish enough, but I don't think they will be foolish enough to put themselves in the middle of it. I think that they'll pawn that off on the federal judiciary. And I think that would be the right call. So those four justices are saying that if the opportunity presents itself, we might be less inclined to go along with the other five and the extent to which they wrote in the majority opinion on this issue.
I'm talking with attorney Bruce Castor, and we're going to take a break right now. We're going to be back with more with Mr. Castor in just a bit when feedback continues here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Stay with us.
Serving Barnesville, Schuylkill Haven, Tremont, and all of Schuylkill County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU. The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond. News Talk 830, WEEU. I'm talking with Bruce Castor, an attorney who was also the lead attorney for Donald Trump during his second impeachment hearing. And we're discussing right now last week's decision by the Supreme Court regarding whether or not states have the authority to block a federal candidate, candidate for a federal office, from appearing on their ballot. Bruce, William Becker, who's an executive director of the Presidential Climate Action Committee, supposedly a nonpartisan climate policy think tank, wrote an editorial in the publication called The Hill. And he referred to last week's decision as, quote, a radical decision by a supposedly originalist court designed solely to shield the former president from the Constitution's sanction against oath-breaking insurrectionists. I'd like to get your take on what he wrote there.
Well, he certainly isn't nonpartisan if he would say something like that. I mean, I don't know how any lawyer could look at what the Colorado Supreme Court did and review the plain language of the 14th Amendment and not know that that was a problem. There were so many legal issues that, I mean, for example, we already talked earlier in the show about the three liberal justices ruling or concurring in the result that Colorado couldn't remove President Trump from the ballot. I mean, those three are as progressive as a federal judges get, and the climate fellow, Mr. Becker, he thinks that this was a partisan ruling by the court. He's doing that without any evidence of that. The legal analysis is so basic. I mean, the most obvious one is the one we talked about before the break, which is at some point, just because everybody says that January 6th was an insurrection doesn't make it so. I mean, that's like everybody saying that the world is flat didn't make it so. You know, there has to be some authority that the United States recognizes by some measure that there was an insurrection to trigger the clause. And I can't believe that any lawyer anywhere thinks that just by saying it enough times makes it so. I can see, for example, the Secretary of State in Maine saying that she's the one who decides who's on the ballot, and it looks like an insurrection to her, and she's presumably either elected or appointed by the governor there, and she has to do her job as she sees fit. I can see that, but she's doing it as an official of the government. Presumably the Supreme Court in Colorado felt the same way, but the notion, and Mr. Becker, in a broad sense, could be totally right as far as this being a decision that's solely for the benefit of former President Trump, but there's no evidence of that. All of the evidence and all of the legal analysis is stacked up against the position that presumably Mr. Becker is advocating. The fact that the amendment says that Congress must enact legislation in order to bring about the purpose of the amendment, and that Congress hasn't done so, that's not a partisan thing. That just hasn't happened because we've had 150 years or more for Congress to do something, and they have chosen not to. So, I mean, that statement is simply uninformed, non-legal foolishness.
Later next month, I want to move on to next month's hearing. The Supreme Court's going to hear arguments on whether or not Donald Trump is immune from criminal prosecution for acts performed while he was president. The court document that I was reading last night that you suggested I read before this interview, and boy, that is a lot of reading for sure. The court document refers to the doctrine of absolute presidential immunity, as well as the principles of double jeopardy, referencing the impeachment trials that Trump went through and was impeached but found not guilty by the Senate, which you participated in one of those impeachment hearings. Can you elaborate on what role those two principles play in whether the judges agree with Trump's assertion that he's immune from prosecution?
Yeah, I paid close attention to this issue because at the time, some media outlets tried to create a conflict between what President Trump was arguing in front of the circuit court and what I said at the impeachment. I said at the impeachment that President Trump enjoys qualified immunity, and if he's engaging in conduct that is in the course of his duties as president, and he's making decisions that are advancing the duties of the president, then he's immune from any actions that he takes while he's in office for the any actions he takes advancing the laws of the United States that he's sworn to enforce. Somehow the media got the notion that my argument was different than the argument that was made by the lawyers in the circuit court, and that the lawyers in the circuit court were, the media claimed, were arguing that President Trump, by virtue of being president, was immune from anything that he did at all while he was president. Now, of course, there's a well-established precedent that the president is not subject to arrest while he's in office. But the media claimed that President Trump was arguing that he was immune from anything he did while president, and that immunity continued after he was no longer president. Well, obviously, he's not immune from committing criminal offenses that are not in the purview of the President of the United States and would be subject to prosecution upon leaving office, which is what I said in the Senate. And I didn't mean for you to have to read that whole thing. I only wanted you to read a small part of it. And to my knowledge, nobody has keyed in on this in the national level. But the crux of the question that went to the Supreme Court on immunity, what the Supreme Court did was it ordered the parties to answer this question, and I'm quoting now from the Supreme Court's order: whether, and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? Now, end quote. That is the Supreme Court articulating what all of us who have ever held public office know as qualified immunity. We would never be able to find anybody who'd be willing to stand for office if every time they had to make a decision, they had to worry about whether they got arrested or could be sued for it. When I was district attorney or attorney general or county commissioner, I made thousands of decisions, any one of which, if it was wrong, could have given rise to civil, and hopefully not criminal, but civil liability. And if my house and my car and my livelihood was threatened because every decision I made I could be sued for, I wouldn't run for office, and you'd never get anybody who was any good who's willing to run for office. So the Supreme Court is taking away the suggestion that President Trump is arguing that he can do anything he wants, and the court is saying that that does the concept of qualified immunity that all elected officials at every level throughout the United States enjoy, does that also apply to the president? Well, the way the question is asked tells you what the decision is going to be. The decision is going to be yes. He's going to prevail on that because that is a bedrock of our Republican form of government, of the Republic, because we who hold public office are elected to use our judgment to represent the people that elect us to that position, and we are granted this immunity from our decisions being subject to civil or criminal penalty as long as, in good faith, we are exercising our duties that we were elected to do. And the wording is even more significant because the Supreme Court says immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office. So what the Supreme Court is saying there is that the overarching concept of qualified immunity is what's going to be debated. There is no chance that that President Trump does not prevail on that. The Supreme Court will rule that the president enjoys qualified immunity for decisions that he makes in the course of his duties while he is president, and that immunity extends for the rest of his life. In fact, if they were to rule differently, they themselves would be giving up their own immunity for decisions they make as judges. But the part to key in on here is alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office. So the court is saying that in the future, if President Trump or those who are opposing President Trump are trying to say that he lacks the immunity, they first have to prove that the acts that he took were not within the scope of his official power and authority.
All right, I need to break there because I've got a hard commercial break coming up here. We're going to continue our discussion in just a minute. Bruce Castor is my guest today, and we'll be back with more feedback in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Tamaqua, Pottsville, Pine Grove, and all of Schuylkill County. This is News Talk 830 WEEU.
Now back to feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
My guest this morning is attorney Bruce Castor, who, among other things in his past, he was the lead attorney for President Trump in his second impeachment hearing. And we're talking about the upcoming hearing before the Supreme Court, where they're going to hear arguments on the president's claim that he is subject to immunity. And Bruce, you were talking before the break about qualified immunity as it pertains to official acts as president. So that leads me to the question then, was the president's speech that he gave on the Ellipse of the White House on January 6th of 2021 an official act? Would that be considered an official act in his capacity as president?
I think there's no question that it is. But the reason I'm pointing out the specific language of the Supreme Court in taking the case is the Supreme Court is telegraphing that becomes a trial court issue. So when and if, first of all, if anybody ever takes the time to watch the speech, it's actually not that vociferous by Trump standards. I mean, I didn't think that it was the kind of speech that rouses passions. But the man is clearly the president of the United States. He clearly believes that the election was faulty, which has always been you hear all these people say that 60 judges or something have ruled that there was no election interference sufficient that it could have changed the outcome. And it always bothered me that there seems to be this general sense that some amount of election interference and some amount of election impropriety is okay, as long as it could not have changed the outcome. Well, at what point does any election no longer become reliable in the eyes of the public if we know that some of it was done improperly? But there's always that tail end part that there wasn't enough election fraud or election misconduct that it would have changed the outcome. And that assumes a fact which heretofore was not in evidence, that that there was election fraud and election improprieties. It's just there wasn't enough of it is what the argument is. But anyway, he's allowed to have his own opinions. And his own opinion was that presumably that the election was improper. It was the first time we had ever done a remote voting because of COVID at the presidential level. And that creates an opportunity for potential fraud. So as the president of the United States, one of his duties is to enforce all of his duties are to execute the laws of the United States. And one of those is the election laws. And because it happens to affect the outcome of the election in which he's in, doesn't make it any less a duty of the president of the United States. And he has a duty, as all of us who held elective office have a duty, to tell the public, to keep the public informed of what we are doing and why we are doing it, if we can do so without causing a some sort of unfairness to a litigant in a case. So I don't see how there's any question that the speech on January 6th was an official act of the president of the United States. I mean, he was president. He's got the seal there. He's speaking on a matter of national importance. And I can't see how it could be anything other than that.
All right, we've got about 3 minutes left. I wanted to get your take on something. Why do you think Special Counsel Jack Smith sought an expedited hearing and judgment from the lower courts on this immunity case?
I thought that was a foolish move because I knew that the issue of qualified immunity would have to be decided because that affects every elected official in the country. So by having it expedited, what he did was get it to the Supreme Court and get to this point faster than otherwise would have. He made the same mistake that the people made in Colorado by forcing that case into the Supreme Court of Colorado. And to the extent that he's a partisan, and I don't know if he is or not, he damaged the left's cause by getting it to this spot. I'll tell you what the Supreme Court is going to do. They're going to rule that the president enjoys qualified immunity and that any acts that he commits that are in the furtherance of any of the duties of office of president of the United States, he's immune from civil or criminal prosecution, and that immunity lasts the rest of their life, and that it is a trial court decision whether or not the actions taken by the president constitute actions taken in the furtherance of the course of his duties. I guarantee you that's how they'll rule.
Do you think this will be a unanimous rule, just like last week's decision was?
The ruling concerning qualified immunity will be unanimous because the country can't function if its elected officials are afraid of being arrested or sued for things that they do in the course of their duties, including judges, by the way. So that part will be unanimous. The part about it being decided at the trial court level, maybe not. Some justices might think that they can decide it on their own without having a hearing. That part I don't know. But the outcome is going to be that qualified immunity exists for the president. It extends until he dies. And it has to be proven at the trial court that he was acting in the scope of his duties for the doctrine to be invoked.
Attorney Bruce Castor has been my guest this morning. Bruce, thank you so much. I appreciate the time you spent with me today. Very enlightening on the things that you shared with us this morning. I do appreciate that.
You're welcome. I appreciate being invited. Thank you.
And I hope that that you'll come back and share your thoughts again on other legal issues here on the show.
Well, if I'm right, you can call me back. If I'm wrong, then don't.
Bruce, thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye now. We'll be back with the final moments of feedback in just a bit. Stay with us.
and weather.
It's the topics that matter to me.
A new generation of talk. News Talk 830 WEEU.